This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orange and Osceola County State Attorney Aramis Ayala is suing Governor Rick Scott after he reassigned cases in her jurisdiction to another prosecutor. She says the governor does not have the authority to remove cases from her office. Ayala's office is also facing a budget cut after her announcement she would not seek the death penalty in any case.
We thought that if she's not going to do part of her job, basically, that we would withhold some of that money pending on what the governor does and so on and so forth.
That's Republican State Representative Scott Plakin, who sits on the House Judicial Appropriations Subcommittee, talking to 90.7 News back in March. Tomorrow, the Florida Supreme Court considers oral arguments from Scott and Ayala in the lawsuit. Renata Sager has been covering the story for WMFE. Thank you so much for joining us, Renata.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Also joined by Tramell Gomes. He's the host of the Rotunda podcast up in Tallahassee. He's been following the story as well. Tramell, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Renata, remind us why this case ended up in the Florida Supreme Court.
This has got to be one of the more controversial cases of the past few years here in Florida. Back in March, State Attorney Aramis Ayala, she made an announcement, a public announcement, in front of her office that she would not be pursuing the death penalty in a case of a man who was accused of having killed a cop and his ex-girlfriend, Markeith Lloyd. And then she went on to say that she actually would not be pursuing the death penalty in any case. And she argued why she wouldn't be doing that. It had a lot to do with funding, the fact that it comes off as fiscally irresponsible, and also the altruistic sentiment that, hey, it does not really produce any sort of justice for the families or the victims. Mm-hmm. And so it just spiraled into a conversation about whether it was her power, it was within her power to do that. And Governor Scott stepped in and he reassigned the death penalty cases to someone else.
Mm-hmm. Tramell, this case has had ramifications across the state of Florida, right? And there are, you know, questions springing from it as to the validity of the death penalty in Florida, too.
That has been going on for quite some time. And the death penalty was not in place. That had to go through legislative review, of which they recently fixed. So the Supreme Court had ruled it unconstitutional, requiring the legislature to go back and fix it. So that's what happened. After the legislature fixed it, Ms. Ayala came out with her news that she was no longer going to file and honor the death penalty based on the factors she laid out.
Mm-hmm. Renata Sago, a group of lawyers and others wrote a letter in support of Aramis Ayala's decision. They stressed her right to, you know, make those decisions and cases in her jurisdiction. So a lot of folks coming out and saying it's really up to the prosecutor's discretion to make these decisions.
Definitely. There have been a lot of friends of the court briefs filed. And it's a controversial topic. You've got victims' family members who are coming out and saying, hey, we are opposed to the death penalty. And one point that Ayala raised in her conversation, that announcement outside of her office, was that, hey, these sorts of death penalty cases, they can take decades. And at the end of the day, between all of the policy changes, it could come to a point where the person who was accused does not end up dead. Another thing that's come up is that there have been some conservative groups that have stepped in, and right, they have also expressed some anti-death penalty sentiment. Just recently, Florida conservatives concerned about the death penalty, a group of Republicans and libertarians, they aligned their argument with Ayala's, but distanced themselves from her politically, but said, hey, death penalty is, it costs a lot of money and it's not effective, and people don't get the sense of justice that they need.
So what happens with the legal arguments this week? Just walk us through the process of the hearing, if you could.
Well, Wednesday, tomorrow, the attorneys for Aramis Ayala and Governor Scott, they will argue before the Supreme Court. They'll have 20 minutes to state their oral arguments, and the justices will have an opportunity to chime in and ask questions. And they will proceed on and make a decision about whether Governor Scott overstepped his authority, which is what Ayala's lawyer has argued, or whether Ayala overstepped her prosecutorial discretion in this.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned all those amicus briefs on both sides of this argument. Do those folks representing those points of view get to make their case in this hearing as well?
They have no word in this, but if anyone is interested in hearing what these folks have to say about it, There are hundreds of pages of briefs online at the Supreme Court website.
Mm-hmm. Let's just talk about the bigger picture for a moment. Renata Sago, Aramis Ayala, you know, her election itself was historic. She's the first African-American state attorney elected in Florida. So what are the optics of the governor removing these cases from her jurisdiction? What does that sort of tell you about this when you take a 30,000-foot view?
Wow. I mean, it has major implications. One group that filed an amicus brief went so far as to say, hey, this dates back to a history of disenfranchisement of not only regular black citizens, but also officials, you know, African-Americans in leadership. So the idea here is that you have someone who was voted in by a large demographic. There was a large margin by which she won the race. And here she is being, they say, stripped of her authority, her ability to exercise her discretion. Another thing here is that Aramis Ayala is one of several state attorneys who were funded by George Soros, a liberal billionaire who's also anti-death penalty.
Mm-hmm. So she, and you're talking about her campaign.
Her campaign, right, mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying here. She was funded by this man, and she maintains having a distance in terms of their relationship. But she's a part of a wave of this sort of progressive mindedness that if you put diversity in public office, especially at the prosecutorial level in these judges' roles, public defender roles, then there can be changes with the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm. Jermell Gomes, let's talk a little bit more about the politics of all this. There was a big debate in the legislative session that just got done talking about the idea of cutting funding for Aramis Ayala's office. The final tally, $1.3 million cut and 21 positions. Talk to us about the politics of that. How did that debate go down?
Well, the politics is pretty much everything. That's what really drove this situation to where it is. It blew up, really, during session. And it became, like you saw, the political divide. It went along party lines. Conservatives, they held a press conference, and they called Aramis Ayala, like, you know, she was like going against the law, she didn't know what she was doing, mm-hmm. and really demanded the governor do something. And then the governor even stepped in and even, like, you know, it just became a really partisan fight, and it was mostly all about the politics. So that's really what it went down to here in Tallahassee.
What about the argument against cutting funding? Of course, State Attorney Aramis Ayala's office, she said that, look, cutting this amount of money, $1.3 million, cutting the staff, that they want to cut 21 positions, rather, that's going to hurt efforts to fight human trafficking, domestic violence cases. There's going to be some political blowback if that happens, right?
That's her argument, and it's rightly so. Like, these offices, usually you come and you're lobbying to get more funding and stuff like that, and to see this go forward based on her stance. And that's one of the things that I'm not a lawyer, but we've seen in times you have to look at the intent of the decision, whether it was, like, you know, it may be an argument for her side, like, what was the real reasoning for this cut? Is it just to punish? And that's what the justices were looking to see, like, you know, was it really because they don't have any funding, or is it really just to punish her? And that's something to really stand on, and we'll see on Wednesday.
Let's talk to a little bit about the statement that Ayala made when she announced that she was not going to be seeking the death penalty, her concerns about that, saying the cases drag on for years. Do you get the sense, Tramell Gomes, that there is, you know, the death penalty's time is up in Florida, or is this just a bump in the road?
When it looks through a partisan lens, and as long as there's a Republican majority in Florida, which there is, and the wave doesn't seem to be changing anytime soon. Democrats have been in the minority for some time now, and they are not looking like if they're getting any stronghold to change that. So the wave is set for those who ideologically are fine with the death penalty, and there's no, I'm not not seeing a window going forward with any changes, at least for the powers that be that are in place right now, even though Renata mentions a conservative group that is now supporting some of the findings that Ayala has put forward. It's they're not really in power to make a big swift, but them coming out is helping the argument to really say this is just not a partisan issue. There's just facts here, and that will help support an argument to see some change moving down the line, but nothing immediate.
Mm-hmm. What about gubernatorial candidates? Are we hearing anything from folks who are running for governor on the death penalty?
Yes, we're hearing from, like, when they're asked about it from on the Democratic side, they were all siding with Ayala. Of course, again, partisan on the Republican side, you're not hearing anything much about them changing. From on the Democrats, Andrew Gillum, it's more forceful. He sides with stopping the death penalty. Gwen Graham, Chris King hasn't been, like, you know, so vocal about it, but as a progressive there, he is going to fall in line, likely, with his Democratic colleagues on the issue. Republicans, as you saw, like Adam Putnam, Commissioner of Agriculture,
yep.
He sits on the cabinet along with the Attorney General Pam Bondi, who Pam Bondi came out very forceful against Aramis Ayala when she made her stance. So everything is going along party lines as we're seeing it unfold.
Mm-hmm.
And just to go along with that, you know, that is evidence of how this case has really brought the idea of the death penalty back into the political conversation. Because in the beginning, when Ayala first made her announcement, there were these questions about, oh, well, you didn't say this when you were running. You weren't open about it. And then there was the pushback of, oh, you know, I was not ever really asked the question about my stance on death penalty.
Both Renata Sago and Tramell Gomes, both of you are going to be following this case as it unfolds on Wednesday, and we'll look with interest how this case progresses. Renata Sago, 90.7's reporter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also joined by Tramell Gomes, he hosts the Rotunda podcast up in Tallahassee. Tramell, thanks a lot.
Glad to be here.
Still to come on Intersection.
You can go skydiving, there are bumper cars, there's a surfing simulator. You know, you've got more restaurants than you could ever choose from.
Keeping the crowds entertained on board a massive cruise ship. And to boldly go to Mars could mean a one-way ticket. So who's interested?
To go and never come back. Maybe they're not realizing that they wouldn't come back. But I would go. Brendan's shaking his head, but I would go.
Space reporters Emily Speck and Brendan Byrne discuss the physical and psychological challenges facing the next generation of explorers. Take Intersection with you. Download the podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can also find us on the NPR One app. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Nearly 26 million people are expected to take a cruise this year, and many of those cruise passengers will set sail from Florida. Stuart Chiron and Monty Matheson join us to explain how the cruise industry is working to attract new customers and build bigger and better ships. Well, Monty Matheson is the managing editor of Cruise Industry News. Monty, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course.
We're also joined by Stuart Chiron. He runs the website thecruiseguy.com. Stuart, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Monty, I want to start with you. According to the Cruise Line International Association's industry trend forecast, 2017 was predicted to be a big year for cruise companies, nearly 26 million passengers hopping on a cruise, and that was up from about nearly 25 million the previous year. How's that prediction holding up? Are those numbers looking pretty good at this point?
Those numbers are right on the money, and that's only the beginning. In the next 10 years, there's going to be unprecedented growth. There's a record order book. It's the biggest order book anyone's ever seen, 90 ships. 10 years worth of deliveries. So that just means more variety for the consumer and probably better pricing going forward, too.
Where are these ships being built?
Primarily, the ships are built at European shipyards, but, you know, they'll be deployed all over the world, from ports in South Florida to China and Alaska and basically everywhere else.
Is that sort of a growing industry in China, like cruise companies originating out of China?
It's growing. You know, people like to compare it to Miami in the 1970s. It's a very, it's a new market. It's an emerging market. The Western companies have gone in. There are two smaller Chinese cruise lines that are run and managed by companies in China. And beyond that, you know, we're expecting more market entrants in the near future.
There's also river cruises, right? Is that sort of trend changing at all? Like, are more people saying they want to cruise up a river rather than on the ocean?
Absolutely. What you see is a lot of people will try an ocean cruise and then go try a river cruise and vice versa. And the river cruises, you know, they're expanding too. It's a much smaller market. You're looking at probably a million passengers at the most on an annual basis. That trend is gonna move here. I expect to see more activity both in the Pacific Northwest, on the Mississippi, and on the Great Lakes in the North American market.
Right, because at the moment, is it more European river cruises that people are taking?
Yeah, at the moment, the big piece of the river pie is in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Stuart, let me bring you in the conversation. You just got back from a cruise in Europe, is that right?
I was actually on cruise 248 and 249.
Okay. When did you start taking cruises? How many? You've done almost 250. How long has that cruise career been?
I'd say over 28 years.
Mm-hmm. Do you take more cruises a year now than you did when you started?
Yeah, there's more cruises. I go in spurts.
What got you hooked in the first place? Because that is a lot of voyages.
Well, I'd say, you know, after having done my first cruise, which was a cruise from Miami to Freeport on what was then Sea Escape, I didn't like it for a day. I didn't know why people did it for a week. And it actually took about 14 months in the industry, in the business, before I took my first cruise. And it was downhill from there. I mean, it's just the allure. It's just the, you know, you're not packing and unpacking. You're not checking in at hotels, not waking up in the same boring place each day. And, you know, every day is an adventure.
Mm-hmm. What about river cruises then? Have you taken some of those in Europe, and could you see that taking off here in the United States? As Monty was saying, it might well do.
Well, the river cruises are, you know, there's people that just like to go into smaller ports, may want to spend more time in certain places that may be landlocked and not available to the larger ships. I personally like the larger ships. There's more to do on board the ship. You know, the ship is also a destination in itself. And, you know, around the United States, it's limited by the places that it can visit. It's great to see a resurgence on the Mississippi River and, of course, the Pacific Northwest. But, you know, some of these other destinations, you know, Monty mentioned the Great Lakes. In certain areas, it does have kind of to the masses, a lackluster appeal.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something that certain cruise lines have been able to do with their larger ships, and, you know, the results haven't been terrific.
Monty, on that issue of bigger ships, I see that Royal Caribbean's Symphony of the Seas, it's more than 1,000 feet long. This thing is huge. It will be the biggest cruise ship when it starts service next year. I mean, what is the benefit of having these bigger boats?
There are multiple answers to that question. You know, first of all, for the cruise company, it's economies of scale. More people, they still need the same set of engines, you know, and they're going to make more money when they put more people on the ship. For the passengers, it's almost an added benefit. Yes, there are more people on board, but the ship is also much bigger. So, you know, space per guest is probably about the same. On the other hand, you have many more dining venues. There's more stuff to do. The new Royal Caribbean ships that you mentioned are so revolutionary. You can go skydiving. There are bumper cars. There's a surfing simulator. You know, you've got more restaurants than you could ever choose from, and top-notch entertainment. So it really will appeal to all generations, you know, baby boomers and millennials. And really also the multi-generational family travel as well.
Skydiving, okay. Explain how that works on a cruise ship.
Well, the Royal Caribbean Quantum class ships have a skydiving simulator on the back of the vessel. It's from a company called iFly that also have land-based simulation centers. And you can go, it's almost like a vertical wind tunnel. You get in a suit and you put a helmet on and you go in there and a big fan blows you up in the air.
Mm-hmm. Stuart, have you tried one of these on a cruise ship?
I have. It's quite an experience. And, of course, the ocean view scenery is pretty pretty stunning. And, you know, Monty mentioned, you know, they also have the flow riders, which are the pools that you can go surfing and boogie boarding. You know, the Oasis class ships have the, you know, the zip lines and, you know, ice skating. So the activities are just endless. I mean, full court basketball. But, you know, of the Quantum class, you know, which Monty was kind of talking about, the neat thing is they brought the basketball court in, made it full court, and it actually there's about six or seven basketball hoops, but they can convert that into roller skating. They can convert that space into a trapeze school. And the bumper cars, it's bigger than, you know, when you, let's say, went to a carnival. But the activities just, you know, keep, you know, going. They keep adapting land-based technologies, putting them on board the cruise ships to make it much more enjoyable for the passenger. And, you know, the good thing is people are willing, are gravitating, they're to it, they're enjoying it, they're spending more money to get on ships that have these kinds of activities. But it's also nice to see more traditional ships that provide a more relaxed, traditional type of a cruising experience.
Right, because some of these boats where you have all these activities, it sounds like a floating theme park rather than a traditional cruise ship. I mean, is there an incentive to even get off the boat at port, or do people just want to stay on and entertain themselves on board?
I'd say it goes both ways. In certain places, especially on the larger ships, for example, the best days are the port days to stay on the ship because you can actually get some deck chairs and enjoy some of the facilities without the crowds. But it's always great to get off the ships, experience, you know, everything that they have to offer. But, you know, some of the ports, some of these passengers have been on multiple cruises, and they do tend to like to enjoy those days on board the ship.
Mm-hmm. What about the price then? If you're getting on one of these high-tech, enormous boats, which has all these amenities, are you paying a little more for your ticket?
There's definitely a premium. And, Monty was mentioning, you know, with the new ship builds, so going back to, the 2017, the outlook is it will be a record year. And all of the earnings calls, all the cruise lines are essentially regurgitating the same statement that their future bookings are ahead, and their prices for those sailings are higher than they've ever been, mm-hmm. which is very good for both the industry and of course the consumer. But you know, there's always going to be beds to fill, and as the industry continues to grow, there's continued more options for consumers. But the types of deals, the aggressive offers that we saw for a period of time during the recent recession, those are not going to be happening. So people really need to be focusing on the bottom line price, not the amenities that a lot of these cruise lines tend to offer, because really what they do is they mask higher pricing.
Mm-hmm. Monty, are cruise lines, cruise companies, are they insulated a little bit from some of the fluctuations that you might see in other parts of the tourism or the travel industry, like things that happen that affect the airline industry? Are they less likely to affect the cruise industry, for example, if there's political instability or, you know, extreme weather? How does that sort of factor into this picture?
Well, the good news is at the end of the day, a cruise ship is movable, right? It's a movable asset, and that's what the cruise industry loves to talk about, that if they're in Eastern Europe and something happens in the world, they can move the ships back here or a more stable area. That being said, you know, it's hard to do that overnight, and if you do it overnight, it's going to hurt people that have cruises booked, and it's going to hurt the bottom line for that season. That being said, you know, a couple of years ago, there were cruises in the Black Sea. There was a lot of capacity and a lot of supply in the Eastern Med, which is a fantastic part of the world. And almost all of that's gone because no one wants to go there due to the geopolitical situation. So those ships have been pulled back, essentially. Some of them are in the Caribbean. Some went to Northern Europe. You'll see a lot of ships in Alaska next summer, which is a nice, safe, amazing and stable destination. In some ways, the cruise industry is isolated from the geopolitical conversation, but in some ways it's not.
What about the weather then? If you're talking about these enormous boats, are they able to better steer through big storms, or do they still have to kind of factor that in and go around them?
They'll put their foot down and go around them.
And the new technology makes it easier for them to do that? Are they able to stay at sea longer, that kind of thing?
Yes, and you know, the cruise lines are have gotten much better with their planning and marine operations teams. Royal Caribbean just brought in a full-time chief meteorologist, which I think is pretty cool. You know, his job is just to look at the radar and advise the ships on what's going on.
Do you think that's a trend you'll see other cruise lines picking up as well?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind that the cruise ships are actually weather centers and do report back to the National Hurricane Center. The hurricanes are tracked both in the office and on board each of the individual ships. So it's not like an earthquake or a tornado where events occur suddenly. cruise ships, and you know, are always working with their home offices and the National Hurricane Center to go around foul weather, including avoiding the hurricanes. And in some cases, it becomes more of an interruption or an inconvenience, where if an impacted port is supposed to be visited, they may steer around it. They may have to shorten their tenure in a port. They may have to actually stay at sea an extra couple days to avoid the home port that may be impacted. Schedules could be changed, but they're not. The good news is that they can track these storms and not have them have to go into them. To maximize and ensure the safety of the ships and the passengers.
What about how this all fits into Florida's economy too? I mean, some of the ports are now able to accept bigger ships. If you talk about the fact that there are more boats being commissioned, more people wanting to take cruises, what does that mean for Florida?
Well, I think the three big ports in Florida all have pretty bullish expansion plans. Miami is building terminals with a number of cruise line partners. Up the coast a little bit in Fort Lauderdale, or better known as Port Everglades, they just announced a big deal to revamp a terminal. Port Canaveral, I think this week, is either going to discuss or vote on some changes to Terminal 3. So, those are the big three ports, and they've been expanding for the last few decades, and they're going to continue to expand. I think Miami is expecting 5 million passengers a year pretty soon, which is just phenomenal to think about. And this is going to have other benefits to the smaller ports. Tampa suddenly has more traffic because there are more ships in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You can see Cuba, the relaxation of the Cuba policy has benefited Tampa. There's a ship in there now for the summer sailing to Cuba. You never know what may happen in Palm Beach or Jacksonville, too.
Mm-hmm. Stuart, I wanted to just come back to something else Monty mentioned, that the idea of multi-generational cruises. Who are your fellow passengers on cruises these days? Are you seeing more millennials, for example?
Well, I mean, the good thing about cruising is that it attracts everybody, but they are always seeking to enhance the experiences to attract, more people. The only reason these ships have gotten bigger from the days of the, the 70s and 80s was simply because they were able to offer, better experiences, and the more people they put on the ships, they did have these economies of scale. They can reduce the cost to themselves, but enhance the overall experiences to the passengers, because they can provide much, greater experiences. But what they've also found is that they don't want to go too over the top, Matthew, because when the ships get too big, it limits where in the world these ships can go. So it's kind of a bit of a quagmire, which is why we're seeing certain cruise lines starting to creep up to the 200,000 or just over the 200,000 mark. But there are limitations of where these destinations could go.
Mm-hmm.
China, for example, doesn't really have, a destination, ports that can handle ships. That's why we haven't seen an Oasis-class ship being deployed to that region just yet. Shanghai and Hong Kong are about the only two ports in the region that can currently handle a ship that's about 1,187 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
But it's only a matter of time.
Well, Stuart Chiron runs the website, The Cruise Guy, and you're heading off on another cruise fairly soon. Where are you off to, Stuart?
Well, back to Europe, taking the family, and we're heading out on Seabourn Encore in the Mediterranean. So there's Cruise 250.
Great. Well, enjoy that cruise, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We're also joined by Monty Matheson. He's the managing editor of Cruise Industry News. Monty, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, what happens if a Martian astronaut goes bonkers?
The only people we can really look to that might relate to that feeling are, as Dr. Wildman was saying, kind of anthropologists can tell us about early colonization and how when they got on a boat and they didn't know where they were going and they thought they would never return. So we can kind of look at that psychology behind that.
Space reporters Brandon Byrne and Emily Speck take a look at the questions scientists are asking about mental well-being for Mars-bound astronauts. And then there's the challenge of just getting there in the first place.
It's an insane idea, but Elon Musk has had a lot of insane ideas work before.
If you missed an episode, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can also find us on the NPR One app and listen on our website, WMFE.org. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. There's a lot going on in the space industry, from new budgets, interplanetary space probes speeding through our solar system, and the public and private sector's efforts to land humans on Mars. So what's going on up there? To wrap up the latest in space news, I'm joined by WKMG's Emily Speck. She's a digital journalist with a focus on space news. Welcome back to Intersection, Emily.
Glad to be back.
Also speaking with 90.7 space reporter Brendan Byrne. He also hosts WMFE's Space Exploration podcast, Are We There Yet? Well, before we get into deep space, let's start here on Earth in Washington, D.C. Brendan, what's happening up on Capitol Hill?
Well, the Trump administration released their blueprint for the fiscal year 2018 budget, which is $19.1 billion going into NASA. Now, that's a half a billion dollars less than the previous budget, but it kind of maintains that same $19 billion ish dollars that have been happening for the past few years within NASA. Now, where you want to drill down and look and see where that money is going. So some money was shuffled around within that big pie of NASA money. Mm-hmm. There have been big increases in planetary sciences this year, supporting big missions like the James Webb Space Telescope. That's set to be launched in a few years. It's a deep space telescope that's going to be about the size of a tennis court. This thing is huge. So a lot of money is going into that. About $2 billion went into planetary sciences this upcoming fiscal year, which is a record high for planetary sciences within the NASA administration ever.
Mm-hmm. What got left out?
So a few things got left out. So there was cuts to Earth sciences. So about $167 million were cut in the Earth sciences division. And I'm going to get a little technical here. I'm going to tell you what was cut and see if you can find the common denominator here. So the Climate Absolute Radiance and Refractory Observatory, the Orbiting Carbon Observatory, and the Deep Space Climate Observatory.
All right. So there's a climate thread running
through
this.
There's a climate thread running through here. So there's no secret that the Trump administration is a bit hesitant on climate research. And those were the things that were cut from the Earth space budget. Financial officers at NASA said they were cut due to, quote, budgetary priorities, but there's obviously something underlying there.
So there's more of a focus on exploration, getting further out, and less on what's going on in the Earth's atmosphere.
That's right. So much more money put towards planetary sciences.
Emily Speck, as lawmakers appropriate a budget for NASA, scientists are thinking about that long-term goal of a mission to Mars. And the Florida Institute of Technology hosted a workshop looking at the psychological challenges of that trip. What are some of the problems that social scientists are looking at?
So this particular workshop was hosted by the Buzz Aldrin Space Institute at Florida Tech. And they're looking at the human-related challenges. You know, what happens when you go on a trip and you are not coming back? So you're going to Mars and you're going to colonize the planet and you're not planning on returning. Those psychological, sociological problems are going to be a little different than, say, if you go to the International Space Station, you know you have a couple months stay and you're going to get to come home and see your family again. So this particular workshop looked at those kind of long-term stays and then beyond that. It was really interesting because they brought together scientists that maybe you wouldn't have normally thought would be in this group, like anthropologists and things like that, you know, brain doctors. It was a very diverse group. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what the workshop was about.
There are a lot of people who say they want to go to Mars, though, right? That's kind of surprising to me.
I mean, not really. I mean, to go and never come back, maybe they're not realizing that they wouldn't come back, but I would go. Brendan's shaking his head, but I would go.
You would miss your Earth comforts, Brendan?
I would. I would miss working with you, Matthew Petty.
Okay, so Emily Speck, what kind of research is going on at Florida Tech looking into the challenges of deep space exploration?
The organizer of this workshop, Dr. Jessica Wildman, she's the director of the Institute for Cross-Cultural Management. She really focuses on group dynamics and things like that. So she and her colleagues interviewed a lot of people to see what kind of experience astronauts, the people who manage astronauts with their day-to-day activities, to figure out what kind of stressors might be out there and how that influences leadership within group dynamics and things like that. You know, if we're sending a group of astronauts to Mars, who's going to develop as a leader? Will there be multiple leaders? You know, how will they deal with the autonomy that they're going to need to have because of the communication delays? So that's what her particular group at FIT is doing. But there are lots of other studies that are long-term space studies currently through NASA as well that she used with her research. And a professor at UCF is also, Sean Burke, is using too. So there's High Seas and Hera. They both look at long-term stays. One of them is in an enclosed facility in Johnson Space Center, and that's if you don't really get to leave the facility, where High Seas is how you go and you live in Hawaii, and it kind of assimilates
Doesn't
Mars.
Doesn't sound too bad.
Well, it's not like you're hanging out on the beach. You're right. hanging out on kind of the side of a volcanic mountain, I believe mm-hmm. it is. So you have to wear your spacesuit when you go outside, and you're following the clock all day long, and you have to live in an enclosed space when you're not outside walking around with your kind of fake spacesuit. So,
mm-hmm. Is this simulation like the Mars length mission duration? Like, would it be the amount of time you would have to spend on Mars?
For Hera, which is at the Johnson Space Center, I think that one goes up to 60 days. And then with High Seas, I mean, Brendan can probably correct me on this one, but it's either a couple months or up to 8 months. Is that the longest?
They're slowly increasing them. So mm-hmm. there's been 6 month right. ones, 8 month ones.
So they are getting there, mm-hmm. but none of these really say no one's coming back. So what's interesting is the only people we can really look to that might relate to that feeling are, as Dr. Wildman was saying, kind of anthropologists can tell us about, you know, early colonization and how when they got on a boat and they didn't know where they were going and mm-hmm. they thought they would never return. So we can kind of look at that psychology behind that. And then also people with terminal illnesses who know that they may not be around longer, which is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at this from all sides to try and figure out how best they can prepare astronauts.
So from the simulations or the tests they're running now at these locations, mm-hmm. has anybody just lost the plot? Like, have there been any people who've just flamed out and had to leave the program?
Not that I know of. Mm. I'm not sure if they would well publicize that if anybody went crazy.
I was at the workshop and I spoke with Buzz Aldrin at the start of the workshop, and he's really worried about people that get there and then realize they've made a terrible mistake. And so that was something that Buzz and his son Andy were kind of steering the conversation that first morning, is what happens if you totally mess this up and realize you don't want to be here anymore.
Yeah. But I don't think NASA is going to send anyone that would happen to. They mm-hmm. do a lot of testing on astronauts, and they, you know, really pick the cream of the crop when it comes to astronauts. Hopefully that will not happen, knock on wood.
Let me come back to the budget for a minute. Brendan Byrne, what about plans in this budget for Mars exploration? Is there money there?
Well, there's robotic money, so robotic exploration. So the Mars 2020 rover that's launching in 2020, there's money for that in there. But there's also some budgeting for NASA's next big rocket that could possibly take humans to Mars. So mm-hmm. the SLS, the Space Launch System, that's the rocket, and Orion. A lot of that work is being done here at the Kennedy Space Center. To kind of develop that capsule and develop that rocket. There was some slight decreases in money for Orion and SLS, but NASA did see an increase in the ground system. So that's the launch pad, the firing mm-hmm. room, all of that stuff. So there's money to develop that. We're still kind of a few years away from seeing that kind of launch, and definitely almost, you know, a decade away from seeing people go on that.
Right.
But yeah, there is some money for Mars exploration.
That big rocket you're talking about, the duration of that development lasts a couple of administrations, right? That goes all the way back to George W. Bush.
Yeah, and there's iterations of it throughout the various agencies. But that one's kind of stuck around, and it's developing, and it's going places. We're starting to see some test hardware being developed. And actually, the Orion space capsule, they finished up their work at Kennedy Space Center, and they've shipped it off for testing for the summer. So it's actually gone. It's out in testing, and hopefully they'll launch that in 2018.
Because they launched a test version of that already, didn't they?
They did. That was EFT-1, and that was launched on a different rocket, actually. So they purchased that rocket from a private company, United Launch Alliance. So the 2018 launch will be an actual capsule launched on the real rocket that NASA wants to send it up on.
Actually, that's been delayed to 2019.
2019. Mm. Yeah. It was November 2018. Now it's 2019.
Yeah, they just pushed it back. This project is already over budget and has experienced multiple delays. So, you know, most recently, I think in a couple of facilities in New Orleans, there was a delay. We're talking about 2019 for the first launch. That's Exploration Mission 1. That was delayed. And then we do know now that there's not going to be crew on that. The Trump administration asked NASA to do basically a study and figure out if they could add crew to this mission. Mm-hmm. And they came back and they said no, citing cost and all the things that they would have to do to the capsule to prepare it to support humans. And it just wasn't going to happen. So we do know now that there will not be crew on that mission.
Mm-hmm. Does tell you a bit about the focus of this administration, though. It's more back to the idea of sending humans out.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to see humans go up in space, too. And I think that they're seeing that there would maybe be more interest if there were people on it. But for a test mission, it sounds smart to me to hold off.
And when you talk to engineers that are working on it, they were kind of very nervous about putting a crew on that first mission as well. So the engineers that are working on the Orion capsule are quite happy that they don't have that added pressure of protecting a human being while they're on that capsule.
Speaking of astronauts, you mentioned the kinds of astronauts who would be going to Mars, the cream of the crop, and there was an announcement made about the next class of astronauts that could one day go to Mars. What do we know about them?
Well, like I said, they're the cream of the crop. They're doctors, they're chemists, they're marine biologists. They really are. We have 12 new astronauts. I think they add to about 40 others. They begin their duty in August 2017, so that's later this summer. You know, we have one Floridian that's an astronaut, Frank Rubio. He's a doctor. They really are just top of the top, and I think that they would definitely live up to the challenge of going to Mars, at least it sounds like to me.
I did not qualify, Matthew Petty.
Did you apply?
Yeah. No, I did not.
Well, you know, there was open application because you could have applied. I didn't apply either, but, you know, maybe next time.
It was the largest applicant pool they received for astronauts.
There were like over 18,000. So for to pick 12 from 18,000, that must have been one heck of a day in HR.
That's kind of interesting. It tells you about the level of interest there is in space exploration at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Going to continue to grow, I think, the more we see humans leave from U.S. soil again, too.
There's a lot of people think that there's waning public interest when it comes to space exploration. And in a sense, there is. But then you see something like 18,000 applicants come in. And it feels good. It's really nice to see that there's people that are interested in space exploration.
We don't know how many of those applicants were just like, I'm just going to apply. Mm-hmm. But you'd like to think that 18,000 people were like, I could go to Mars and not come back. So that's an interesting thought to have.
So one key figure in this push to explore Mars and get out into space in general is SpaceX is Elon Musk. He's been hashing out more details about his colonization plans. Brendan Byrne, what do we know about that?
Well, that's a lot different than the cream of the crop, the 12 people that NASA select. Elon Musk wants to put like millions of people on Mars and colonize it. So he made this announcement last year about his plans to colonize the Red Planet. And just recently he published a paper with all of these findings in a peer-reviewed journal. It's called Making Humans a Multiplanetary Species. So basically what he wants to do is he wants to build almost like these interplanetary cruise ships. So these things are massive. They're huge. They're bigger than the Saturn V rocket. And they'll get launched up into low Earth orbit, and then you'll get ferried up there, and you're put onto these cruise ships, and then you're sent to Mars, and it lands on Mars, and you stay there forever. So that's what he wants to do. It's an insane idea, but Elon Musk has had a lot of insane ideas work before. So he's started to work on this. He's building the fuel tanks that he would need for something like this. He's developing the Raptor engines that are going to power this booster. And he wants to have a lot of people there. He needs 1 million people to sustain a city on the surface of Mars. And that's what he wants to do. And the interesting thing is, like, he talks about the ship. He wants to make it like a cruise ship. So there would be like you'd play zero gravity games while you're en route to Mars. Because it's going to take a few months to get there. He wants to have, you know, like restaurants and pizza places and bars. And so something that you'd enjoy the trip there, which would be great because then you would get to the surface of Mars and there would probably not be much awaiting you there. So it'd be your last hurrah before you got to the Red Planet for the rest of your life.
What happens to the ship? Does it come back to Earth?
It comes back, yeah. So the ship would be reused. It has to be reused up to 1,000 times for this to be financially possible. So that's a lot. He's putting a lot in rocket reusability. And the thing is, it would cost about $10 billion to get someone like you, me, or Emily to the surface of Mars now. And he wants to bring that down to $200,000. So the mortgage of a house or a house payment would send you to Mars. And that's the plan. And that's why he needs to use reusability to get there.
And, of course, he has a pretty grim vision or grim outlook for planet Earth. He's saying that we need to colonize other planets or we're in big trouble.
He thinks this is the key to our species surviving, is colonizing Mars.
Emily Speck, there's some robotic exploration going on up on the Red Planet. What's happening there and what are you looking forward to?
So there's quite a few missions, robots there that are hanging out. We've got Mars Curiosity. And in 2020, we're going to have another rover that's going about the size of a car, Mars 2020. It doesn't have a new name yet. It will have a better name eventually. And the good news is it was included in the 2018 budget, so we know we're still going forward with it.
Is there going to be a competition to name it?
NASA has done a lot of public interest kind of solicitation, so who knows? So basically 2020, it's going to be kind of like a beefed up twin of Curiosity, a whole new set of science instruments. You know, it's going to be searching for signs of life. It's going to search for things that we don't know are there. You know, you can't really identify things, signs of life, if you're not entirely sure what it is. So it's also going to have a microphone on it, which is exciting for you guys. So we'll hear some sounds from Mars for the first time, which will be pretty interesting. I believe they're going to have the microphone on for landing and everything. It's just going to be on for the whole time. So that's pretty neat. You know, it's got Sherlock. It's this instrument, which uses a UV Robin light scanner to look for kind of those unknown things. We're not entirely sure. The colors reflect different things, and we can identify organic compounds that way. So that's pretty cool. And then there's another instrument called MOXIE, which creates oxygen from the Martian air, which is way cool. We've heard about that from The Martian. So that's kind of neat. And that's very important because we're going to need oxygen. If you think about all the things that we're going to have to bring to Mars, you know, if you think about going camping, like all the things you need that you don't have at home, we can't just bring tons of oxygen with us. That would take up so much space. So to have an instrument that can create oxygen, that's going to be vitally important.
What about Cassini? That's exploring Saturn and is wrapping up its mission this year. What are we expecting from the final days of that mission?
Well, I'll probably cry because this mission has been so amazing to explore Saturn. It's ending in September after almost 20 years in space. We've seen just absolutely beautiful images. You know, I've shown them to people and they've thought they were fake. So not because they don't believe in space exploration, but just because they're that beautiful. We've seen great images of Saturn's moons and its rings. Right now, Cassini is in a 6-month period of its like grand finale where it's been diving between the rings, and eventually it will kind of dive bomb into the planet and break up kind of like a meteor. But we're going to start seeing even better pictures of the rings as it takes these dives in between the planet and the rings. So we'll see close-up images. We've already learned a lot about the rings itself, you know, that most of them are made up from the moons, and just how much the moons of the planet kind of influence those rings. So it's really cool. I think we're going to learn a lot to come. And then even after the mission, there will still be data to analyze for years.
And the reason it's crash landing under the surface is so that it doesn't contaminate any of the moons of Saturn, which scientists believe have signs of life on it. So we're not littering. We're getting rid of our trash.
Yeah.
I guess there'll be a watch party for that crash and burn, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the last couple missions that have ended that I've paid attention to, they've had pretty big, you know, it's a big deal. And for, you know, the mission scientists and managers that are on it, it's, they've been, I mean, 20 years, like, you know, that's a really, really long time. So it's not just, it's no small thing.
And it's snapping pictures all the way down.
And if you, I do want to give a shout out. If you're on Twitter, you should follow Raw Cassini, because every day when new images come in, it's like, it's a Twitter bot. So it tweets out all the new images and my feed just blows up with, you know, rings or like maybe the moon Enceladus, like you see some plumes. It's just, it's really, really cool to see, you know, you're on Twitter, people are tweeting about, you know, a president or something. And then, hey, look, it's Saturn. It's just really, really neat. So give it a follow if you're trying to get involved or interested.
It's kind of appropriate that in this age we have a selfie-obsessed spacecraft that's wrapping up its mission. Well, Emily Speck is with WKMG. You can follow her space reporting online at clickorlando.com. Thanks for joining us, Emily.
Thanks so much.
And we were joined by 90.7's space reporter, Brendan Byrne. You can follow his space reporting by subscribing to the podcast, Are We There Yet? Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Matt.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The show's executive producer is Catherine Welch. If you missed an episode, you can find us online, WMFE.org. Listen on the NPR One app or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.